Hey, Pulp fans, thanks for your support. Whether you're subscribing to the podcast through iTunes, visiting pulpmx.com, streaming the show via the Stitcher app on your smartphone, or buying from our show sponsor, btosports.com, without you, we could not do this. You can still type M-A-T-T-H-E-S upon checkout at btosports.com if your order is $100 or more for a discount. Lastly, for some insider info and maybe a laugh or two, follow Mathis's Twitter updates at twitter.com/pulpmx.
Disclaimer.
During this episode of the Steve Mathis Show, there is a high
chance ability
you will either learn something
a lot of people don't know,
you left thinking, or make you say to yourself,
dude, that's so funny.
The bottom line is,
this podcast serves as archival
documentation
of this interview.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast Show. I'm your host, Steve Mathis, as usual. With me on the line is a guy that has done it all, from racing at the highest level to starting a company to developing motorcycles to still winning races to, God, I don't even know. And that's Doug Dubach. Dr. D, what's up?
Not much, Steve. It's good to hear your voice. I know our paths don't cross too much anymore, but
yeah,
it's always good to hear an old friend's voice.
Yeah, I was writing questions down for this thing, and I mean, obviously Terry Beal, your right hand man there at Dr. D wants to talk about your 20% off right now that you're running. he wants to talk.
He's always got to throw that sales stuff in.
Yeah,
I just want to talk about racing, but yeah, I guess.
Okay. Let's get that out of the way. So Dr. D's got 20% sale on exhaust pipes right now.
Yeah, well, it's a holiday promotion we're doing, and, you know, it's on all the products across the board, not just, you know, some last year models or random selections. It's everything, all our brand new stuff, you know, from all our AMA legal, FIM legal, whatever your flavor is, we'll sell it to you at that discount through, yeah, I believe it's the end of January is our holiday promotion.
All right, cool. So there we go, Beal. where do we start? Let's talk about the pipe business. Let's go there first. How's things going? How is it? Year five? Year six?
Well, we're getting up a little further than that.
Okay.
We're closing in on year 10.
Ah, yeah.
So, the first 3 years were playing around, just kind of doing things that I was so passionate about, and you know, it's actually turned into a business.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how that just sneaks right up on you. You get a whole load of employees and buying buildings and machines and equipment, and then one day you just stand back and you go, wow,
yeah,
this is a viable business here. I've gone from small to medium business now by what the government standards are.
Yeah, yeah. And how's sales? How's that going, the battle with the exhausts?
Well, you know, I'd be lying to you if I said it was great, but I think we're doing pretty well. From, you know, word on the street, as they say, is there's a lot of trouble, especially the OEMs. You know, I know a lot of those numbers, and I'd have to say we're doing pretty fair. We're, you know, last year and the year before, we're up huge numbers, and just I think that's our growth. You know, we're getting our legs, and we're really starting to get aboard on some, you know, respectable race teams, as well as just, you know, everyone that touches and feels a DRD product generally is a repeat customer, so they tell two friends and so on and so on. So, yeah, I think we are finding our stride, but, yeah, the economy, you can't argue with that. it's tough this year to continue that kind of growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I know from magazine guys and racers that I know you make a good product, and it's well made. Do you feel like you need to like almost step into that next realm and get on a factory bike, a factory team? Is that sort of the goal?
But, you know, we're walking before we run there. You know, I've mm-hmm. been around this industry long enough to see a lot of people pour, you know, money into a lot of pits.
Right.
And so, you know, I love being involved in the sport, obviously. And I know a lot of these top teams and managers. You know, I've raced against half of them, from Larry
exactly.
Brooks to the Kehoes to, you know, we've all thrown down some serious battles in our professional careers. But the bottom line is it does take dollars, you know, that checkbook. And it's not something that I have to stand there with my chest puffed out that I've got my pipe on, you know, someone right. Dungy's bike or, who, you know, put an insert name here. But
right.
So I like what I'm doing. I'm not, you know, eager to step onto that premier team.
Mm-hmm.
If the opportunity comes, we can certainly do it. You know, we do everything and all the materials from tie and carbon, and, you know, we've got the product there, but, you know, I'm just not willing to write that big check. My ego's not that big to, you know, stand next to a car, you know, a Stewart or a Millsaps or somebody. But, you know, one day it'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
It'll just be the course of things. And then when you ask me that question again in a couple of years, I'll go, yeah, okay, we finally made that decision to do that, make that next step.
Right, right, and it was time. How did you get into the pipe business? I know, you know, I mean, obviously, for anybody who doesn't know, Doug raced professionally for, God, I don't know, 20 years.
Eons, back when they were dinosaurs. And
exactly, and you know, you turned that into a successful R&D job with Yamaha, working on next year's models and testing for Dunlop, probably testing for a bunch of people. And then you branched off and opened up your DRD exhaust company. How did that come about? Did you find yourself just really able to test exhausts really well or something? I'm interested in that.
Well, you know, I'll try and give you the Reader's Digest version. obviously, you've covered most of it right there. I went from kind of starving, you know, driving a pickup truck, peanut butter and jelly and a loaf of bread all of my early career to becoming kind of this test guy, you know, through doing a lot of work with just a lot of the local guys, you know, Paul Theta Race Tech and, you know, kind of eventually ended up doing some tire testing. And then I remember the day because Ed Scheidler reminds me every time we get together and have lunch, you sat on my bumper at Mammoth and said, use me and come on, can I test? And it's funny the way he tells it, but you know, that was almost the biggest mistake, but also the biggest opportunity that ever opened up for me. And I became one of Yamaha's test guys. And through just, you know, my knowledge, my experience, you know, I grew up in a family. My dad was a drag racer. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, I could tell you the firing order of a Chevrolet when I was 7 years old. And, yeah, I just always had that kind of motorhead passion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that opened a lot of doors for me. I understood the mechanics of a machine, be it, you know, learning of suspension and tires, but just the engines. So I could always communicate to the engineers really well. And that just continued to open doors and doors and doors. So by the time I got through the tail end of my professional racing career, there was a lot of demand for a guy that could, you know, with that skill, I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
So I did everything from, you know, factory KYB would hire me, you know, outside of my Yamaha work. And then obviously I'm going into my, I want to say 23rd, 24th year at Yamaha as, you know, one of their lead test riders. So all of those things, one feeds on the other. You know, you gain experience by, you know, being in those circles and sitting in those meetings with all the engineers and just communicating out at the racetrack and seeing how they develop products. So just all that kind of stuff took me to, you know, around the time we were finishing up YZ400 and beginning YZ250F.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to help a lot of our current local Southern California pipe guys develop their pipes. And I was so frustrated with you know, a couple things. A, their interest in four strokes. I seem to be the only guy that could see the future. My crystal ball was working and the rest of theirs wasn't.
Yeah.
Or the guys that had interest in actually pursuing the four stroke stuff were a little too, I don't have a good word, but just believed too much in this dyno and, you know, these theories and things. And I had so much experience from working with the YMC, the Yamaha team, on developing the 400 and tested a million pipes and really connected, you know, dyno to track to finished product, that I was pissing and moaning to my wife one night about how frustrated I was. These guys, they always want to shove the dyno good one at me, and I'm like, that's the last one I'd pick. This one's good. And she's going, well, you should just do it yourself. You know, you're always tinkering. You're always your hands on. You know, I've always been a builder kind of a person.
Right.
And so I laughed her off, of course. And then about a week later, I was filing for a business license under the name of DRD, Dubok Racing Development. So I know it was a little longer than the Reader's Digest version, but I just... It dawned on me. I talked to a couple of key friends that just said, "Dude, you are the guy."
Right.
As much as I denied it, I'm like, "Yeah, I just love to ride motorcycles. I love to tinker." But yeah, obviously that personality fits the business I've created. So
yeah, interesting. Now I just read an old magazine that says you refuse to get off of an 81 RM 125, and you kept buying them over and over.
That is true, and Mitch Payton probably told that story, because he's the one that still makes fun of me to this day that, you know, as, you know, stories grow, as decades go by, I had you know, according to him, a full factory ride with $1 million salary and six mechanics, when really they signed over a loan pool bike to Jody Weisel that I could ride, you know. That was
Who did? Suzuki did?
No, Honda did.
Oh, Honda did, okay.
Yeah, you turned down a Honda factory ride to continue to race your Suzuki. Well, being, you know, a test guy with some experience, I just said, Mitch, you know, that bike was kind of not so good that year. And,
yeah.
You know, I said, yeah, this bike's working great. I would rather continue to race this, because my success at this point was more important to me than, you know, a half of a free bike. Because I think at that point I already owned the Suzuki that I'd bought used and rebuilt from the ground up myself.
Right.
So, yeah, that will stay with me forever, that story. Wow. And if it ever tries to die, Mitch will relive it for me. So,
what I'm wondering is, okay, so if you rode Suzuki's in 82, 83, when did you start testing with Yamaha? Was this around that time? How long have you been testing?
Yeah, it was around 85, late 84, early 85, that I started doing just some basic testing for Yamaha.
25 years of testing bikes.
Yeah, about 25 years.
Ah.
So, it was the 86 model, so I want to say it was by like January 85.
Okay, all right. Wow,
so,
I didn't know it went that far back. I thought, you know, I remember reading stuff in 89 and 90 that you were testing, but I didn't realize it went that far back.
Talking
a little bit about your beliefs of starting DRD, is that what you believe in as far as an exhaust company? Like, I mean, you could make a pipe that hits 60 horse on the dyno, but no one can ride it, and you have the track feel of a guy who's literally put in 8 million laps in his life, where you're like, hey, I want a pipe that's going to deliver power that's trackable and hooks up smooth and allows a guy to ride it. Is that sort of philosophy you go by?
Well, that is, you've hit the nail on the head pretty much, and I'll expand on it a little without boring you or anyone that's going to listen to this. It's, you know, back in the day, you know, you had Damon Bradshaw, Jeff Emig, and myself, all different personalities, yet Bob Oliver could build a ferociously fast YZ250 two-stroke engine.
Right.
And, you know, Damon loved it because he was, dare I say, too stupid to know better. I like Damon. We still talk regularly. I'd say that right in front of his face. But he had that just tenacity to ride whatever you put under him, and would just make it work, because he was determined and, you know, still one of the best talented guys out there. But, you know, Emig was always struggling with the power, and I had, you know, I went completely away from that fast motor that Bob would develop, and it was kind of an interesting turn of events. I won't say what color the bike was, but there, within production testing, I said, hey, you know what? This is the kind of power that I've been trying to describe for a long time on a certain production bike. And So it was a big internal fight, and we ended up letting Damon ride this thing, and he's going, "That's the fastest bike I've ever ridden. Would you, how? There's no way. That thing's amazing." And we're going, "Yeah, that thing makes about 11 horsepower less than your race bike."
Right.
So that and a number, I could sprinkle stories out for the rest of the evening.
Yeah.
But that kind of theory is something that I understood way early on and, you know, continued to learn and embrace that all through my Yamaha testing years, that those numbers are just that.
Yeah.
They're numbers. But you've got to put everything all into what you're asking from that bike is what you need delivered from that bike,
mm-hmm.
not some, you know, printed line on a piece of paper. That really is more for bragging rights. You know, if we all own dynos, I could have a higher line than your line was produced. But that is, in a nutshell, what I have understood and really pursued in my business since day one, because I knew that, you know, I ignored the dyno. I own one, so I can't completely bash them. You know, we use it for a lot of reason and, you know, technical understanding of this and that. But we also have data acquisition, which is a key thing that we've incorporated, and I learned from my Yamaha years, that if you're talking an area, a throttle position, an RPM, that is where you'll find, okay, I don't like it here. And then you have your little trigger on the, you know, it replaces your kill switch. You mark that information and you go, oh, at 35% throttle, at 6,900 RPM, that's what I'm feeling. And that doesn't really show a dip on the dyno, but that's where I'm feeling a soft spot. So then you can further pursue that and, again, identify one guy's low is another guy's mid, so when you get other guys that are out riding and testing with you, oh, this one's got a ton of bottom, and the other guy, oh, it's got a ton of mid with no bottom, and, you know, so you can really start to, through data acquisition, understand exactly the areas that you're looking to improve. So all of that kind of put together is, you know, what I'm about. It's the knowledge that I bring to the table, and that's how we develop the pipes.
Interesting. Yeah, I you know, as Ferry's mechanic for 3 years there, and he was hurt often enough that I got to spend a lot of time on the dyno. And funny thing, I remember at a Cahia Creek one day, Jimmy Perry brought out a Rinaldi system that was, the can had to have been, you know, 25 inches long, and also and a camshaft as well. And the guy, it was slow. It sounded slow. It looked slow. Yet, guess, you know, they were faster on it, and they Reed preferred that because he could wick the throttle open and not worry about, you know, the wheel spinning and pulling off the back of the bike. So I understand where you're coming from totally. It's interesting. The data acquisition thing is really interesting because you're right. Again, you know, we would hook it up and we would go to the track and we would ask Villeman, you know, where are you wide open? And he would point to four spots, and we'd go back to the shop and look at the data, and he was wide open for, like, I don't know, 0.3 seconds or something on a supercross track. You know what I mean? Like, just funny.
Well,
how,
no, that's,
you know,
the funny thing, because we all did that when we first had that acquisition. Scheidler, again, oh, yeah, how much do you think you're wide open? And you're like, oh, at least there. 30% of the time.
Right.
Yeah, and it was like 1.3% of the time you hit 100% throttle.
Yeah.
For, like, any recordable amount of time. So and that's another thing where a lot of people don't understand. Most dynos, all you're doing is you're turning the throttle wide open in a chosen gear, you know, third gear, fourth gear, whatever, and you're running it up through the RPM. But how often on a racetrack do you shift your bike up to a really tall gear and go from almost idle and crack it wide open and wait for it to hit the rev limiter?
Right.
Because that's a measure of dyno. And again, you know, I can't pick on them completely because we use them for, you know, kind of checking this, looking at that, and whatnot, but yeah, that seat of the pants testing is what develops good, true in the field product.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you're, especially, you know, back when I rode a lot of supercross, that jump on, jump off, that kind of response, how that responds at a certain RPM on different tracks, and even on a basic motocross track, just hooking up from a corner, making a little transition, getting back on the gas, and I could start talking about 500 RPM cells, and I could really confuse you with the kind of technology that's attached to data acquisition that just makes more of a three-dimensional picture of a bike's performance than that sort of two-dimensional back wall, I call it, of a dyno run.
Right, right, yeah. And you know, I don't know anybody else who does the data acquisition to develop pipes. Maybe they're all doing it, but that's interesting take on it. I think that would work really well in a development stage, you know. So
it just leaves a lot less to chance, you know, because I'm not picking on anyone. You know, everyone makes good product. That's, you know, what allows them to be in business. But I think you'll find less of a chance of any kind of little pits or dips or things when we deliver a product, because through the seat of the pants on track style, we filled in most of those gaps.
Right, right. And do you yourself get on each bike? And you're
pretty much, you know, as much as everyone picks on me. Oh, you're just going riding again, which is most of true. Don't let anyone hear this outside of this room. But yeah, I mean, I do. I ride every single one, every color, every displacement. You know, it's something I enjoy. I mean, that's what keeps me fit enough to go and still win races, as you mentioned early in this conversation. So, yeah, I do. I ride every last one of them, and, you know, I'm a lucky man. I love my job, and, you know, it wasn't by a kind of divine plan from when I was a young child. It was just I followed my passion, and here I am.
How old are you now, Doug?
I'm 47.
47.
And a half.
It's funny because I was just talking to Lachine the other day, and you know, he said he could keep you in sight for a few laps at the World Vets, and that was pretty good for him. And I know, come around Glen Helen National Time, or it used to be Glen Helen National, come around National Time, a 47-year-old man like yourself is often the gauge for some of these pros. Like, I got him handled. Or I was pulling Dubak a little bit, so I'm happy. You know, it's just so funny to hear these top pros still today measure their speed at Glen Helen versus you. It's just
hilarious. You know, it's funny because it exists day in, day out. Because, you know, I'm out there quite often, as you know, testing and whatnot. And I have to, you know, kind of tone it down and exit and then rejoin on the track because, you know, like Steve Butler, he'll go, dude, you know, we got work to do here. I'd hook in with a, you know, a Weston Pike or somebody, and I'll be out there for like 10 laps when I was only supposed to check, you know, handle grip glue for one lap or whatever it is. So, it's a tough thing to completely. I'm about 9 steps through that 12-step process of getting unhooked from dirt bikes.
Yeah, really, huh? That's just funny. It's credit to you. Hey, is there one, is there one model that really does well with an exhaust change? Is there one that comes to mind that benefits greatly?
You know, it's funny. It is almost color to color, from year to year, and displacement to displacement. Certain ones, I like to say that the OE leaves a lot on the table for us, and that those are nice because then those are the customers that send you back emails. Oh my goodness! Right. And you know, they're totally excited. And then there's others that it's a far less of a gain, but. Yeah, you know, it's just kind of comes and goes, and I think any manufacturer or, you know, any exhaust guy would tell you that yeah, they often leave some on the table and some leave less on the table. But again, I'm trying to shape it, so I'm looking for kind of weak areas, and I'm trying to, you know, maintain the strong parts of a particular system because, you know, I think that customer, that's what he expects. He wants you know, just like anything, you jump on a bike, oh, these forks are too soft, or this is this, or that is that. You set out to fix the things that are not at a level you expect them to be, and that's kind of where we go, too.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Now, in your racing career, you know, you were a factory rider for a couple years? 2 years?
From,
factory support,
yeah, like
factory
89
rider.
Through 93, officially. So, like 5 years on that level. You know, 88, I can remember riding Mickey Thompson, one of those old races.
Yep.
I got Brock's bike, and it's kind of a long story how it came to be, but yeah, I got to ride a really good bike in 88 at one of those Mickey Thompson races, and so, you know, being involved with the testing and whatnot, it certainly helped open some doors because those guys, you know, at that time I wasn't winning races or on the podium, but, you know, through just all the work that I put in for them, they, you know, showed in return some good parts for me and whatnot, and that kind of opened the door for me to get on the race team.
Right.
Well, yeah, because even like the end of '88, I had some good forks and good shot, you know, and I got my first Supercross podium, you know, as just a guy showing up in his own van with a, you know, one bike in the back. Mm-hmm. So L.A. Coliseum, and you speaking of the Dogger and Brock, Brock won it. And the Dogger got second, and I was third. So it was pretty cool to stand on the podium with those guys.
And it was Brock's last ever race for Yamaha, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah. What I was getting at, what my question was for you was, do you feel like certainly you were a top-notch rider, national number 7 one year, national number 16, national number 11?
12 yeah, okay. I think I had about every number right. in that, about an 8-digit spot. I had 12 and offered 13, even though I wasn't bold enough to take it.
Yeah.
You know, 14, 15, 16, 21, yeah, I mean, yeah. I had them all in there.
Do you feel like maybe, like, if, and I talked to Holly about this too in his career too, because he feels like he left some on the table with his racing, worrying about making money. But do you feel like you left some results on the table because, hey, I got a test the next week. Hey, I can't do motos today because I have to test. Like, you know, do you feel like if you just would have been like 110% racer dude, you might have had better results?
Yeah, you know, that's hard to say. Maybe a very small 3% that, you know, is in my back of my mind somewhere. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I certainly recognized opportunity. I tried to capitalize on all my situations, and certainly that existed. You know, the Mickey Diamonds and the Bradshaws and the Emigs, they would go home because they would go rest or get their nails done or buy a new stereo, whatever they were doing. And I was always there for an extra 2 or 3 hours doing all the extra work, and
right.
So yeah, I was more of the workhorse of the crew, not that whatever name you want to attach to it. But but truly, I think there was, just like anyone's career, you can take two real top guys, one of them becomes Ricky Carmichael, and the other one becomes not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, injury, and just there's so many little things that factor in, and so I wouldn't really change anything, and I'd like to have back a handful of injuries. I think that would have had a certain impact, but the bottom line is, yeah, I did have my eye on, you know, a little bit of a Jim Hawley, the work I did and the doors that opened, the opportunities that created for me, mm-hmm. because I did have a little eye on beyond this Supercross tonight.
Yeah.
You know, through my whole, because, you know, arguably I kept my job a little longer because I was that kind of solid guy. You know, I trained hard, and I tried to be sort of this leader of the team, even though I wasn't the fastest guy, you know, with the Bradshaws and, you know, Mike Craigs, and the list is pretty long of the different guys on those several years that I was on Yamaha's race team. So, you know, being a little more of a stable veteran, it did extend my career there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, so you're happy with it. What was it like being on the team all those years through the different personalities, from a Glover to a Mickey Diamond, who was going to be the next thing, Emig, Bradshaw? I mean, you literally, the one constant was Doug Dubak sitting there at testing.
Yeah, well, and just what I just got through explaining, I think that certainly helped me, because there was, you know, most of the guys you mentioned at one time or another were faster than I was,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, often I'd beat most of those guys in any kind of a points series for the year, because, you know, I was that kind of working horse guy that just got it done and got a lot of, you know, between thirds and sevenths, mm-hmm. you know, I was guy.
Yep.
But, it was interesting, you know, I could tell stories again for the rest of the night about this personality or that personality, but, you know, I was that, glue that tried to get everyone focused and going, and, you know, even during the week, you know, Bradshaw and I, we were pretty close through a lot of those years, as close as anyone got to Damon, I should say, but, you know, it was, he was an interesting guy, and, you know, the Emigs and, you know, the Mike Craigs and
Larry Wards,
and there was just so many guys, you know, kind of, I think, 89, my first real year of getting some good stuff. It was a big team from, you know, Kalos and, you know, a lot of guys in there, LaRocco, and it was some good memories, I guess.
I did one of these with Bradshaw, comprehensive one, and Said he hated everybody except for Dubak.
See, I wasn't just fooling myself that he liked me. He said something nice.
He said he hated everyone on the track except for Dubak. He liked Dubak, but still, he said in 91 Super San Jose, when you won, he was going to plant you in that next corner. He just ran
absolutely
out of laps.
I'm so thankful it was the checkered flag and not the white flag. Because I think he still had rays. There's a little video thing we played at the Indy Trade Show a couple years ago. Uh-huh. He's whacking me on the helmet out of excitement, but that was my joke. I go, he was just pissed there wasn't one more lap.
I said to him, I'm like, come on, you got to let Doug, win one. He's like, no way, man, no way. I was planting that sucker over that next berm. I ran out of laps, and I'm just like, oh, man.
But he did call his mom at 4 in the morning, her time, and the first words out of his mouth, race report, that I won. He was so excited that I won. By the time we got to Chili's or wherever, he was happy I won, and he wasn't just pissed that he didn't have another lap.
It had to have been kind of a shock when he fell apart there in 92 at the Coliseum. That was definitely a turning point in his career, and probably at Yamaha even also.
That was so hard for me to sit and watch, as anyone, but I was pretty close to him, obviously, and I had a big crash in practice and hurt my wrist pretty bad. And so I went through, qualified for the main and whatnot, but I pulled off about halfway through, just unable to hold on. And just watching that whole thing unfold from the infield was sickening. It was so hard. But, I know there's a million conspiracy theories of what went on that day and before and after. But it is, I challenge anyone to be in that situation and do better, because that was a tough one to handle.
I would guess your career highlight would be the 91 San Jose Supercross, winning that?
In the record books, but there were certainly some more satisfying races because, as you knew, Chicken and Coop crashed.
Yeah.
I was still pretty close to those guys, but one of them likely should have won. Thankfully, it was me instead. So racing's racing, and you got all that, and I'm in the record books winning. But I thought, okay, I got my first one out of the way, and we're going to go on, and then another injury the new year before the season even began the next year and whatnot. So it was tough. But some of my bigger wins were over in Europe, because it seemed like those were sort of building up to, and then before I had my injury that following year to start 93.
Right.
I battled with Jean-Michel Bale 20 laps in Switzerland at the Geneva race. That was a huge event over there, and won handlebar to handlebar, beating Lachine and Albertine and you name it. The list was long. So I had some great wins that were certainly more satisfying. But in the record books, that one is, you're going to take that one because it's it means a lot.
Let's talk about the R&D and development side. Now, obviously, you were a point man on this four-stroke revolution that Yamaha started. When did you first ride a YZ400? When did you first think that, hey, these guys are really going to bring this thing out?
Well, it's funny because someone at Yamaha will listen to this and want to choke me. But, when I first heard it, I think I felt, as a lot of people did, everyone pictured Spud Walters riding that XR400,
yes,
popping and crackling and bottoming out over every jump. And I'm like, oh, no, please, please. But, it was early 96. When we rode that thing. We rode it at Carlsbad, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, you guys are trying to, just pedal this thing to me, because Carlsbad's the place you would take a four-stroke because it's so slippery and baked.
Absolutely.
And, the first time, it wasn't exciting, but it was about 10 times better than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, okay, it's, could be something. And then, each generation of that early project would come back a little more refined, a little better looking, a little less handmade parts on it, and the thing started getting pretty good. And I had the opportunity where I was helping the race team at the same time, because I still did a lot of race team testing. Excuse me. And so I had ridden Doug Henry's works bike.
Right.
And as fast and furious as that bike was, and Henry will tell you the same thing, the production bike was actually a better overall package, just more manageable. Mm-hmm. Chassis was a little friendlier. There's a lot of good things about that. So I kind of grew with both of those projects, trying to get that race bike to be a little more rider friendly, and, you know, trying to take this a little too dulled down 400 and bring it up to like what Henry's race bike was. We're trying to get them both to this happy medium. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was just a great experience and something that, you know, I'll always cherish because, yeah, I was a guy that was seeing stuff that no one was able to see and, you know, got to ride these super exotic things alongside with this project that no one knew was really going to come to fruition. So that's very, very, very cool times and meetings and days at the track in that project for sure.
There are probably days in Japan as well, right?
A lot of plane flights.
A lot of plane flights.
Yeah, I saw a lot of rainy days in Japan, too. It seemed like we kept getting rain trying to get that bike going. But
did you have any idea where, well, you said, you kind of hinted earlier that you did, but did you have any idea that these things were going to basically exterminate two-strokes, that they were going to be that good?
Yeah, I think I was one of the only ones. You know, I know Doug Henry was paid to have those same thoughts, but, you know, I think still in there he had, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it well, as Doug did everything well.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think I was one of the few that really understood what was going to happen, that, yeah, once these things get a little lighter, a little stronger, a little everything, you can't get that kind of power delivery with a two-stroke, you know, at least not anything that we had ridden up to that date, not anywhere close. So I had that feeling, and, yeah, it was just something that it took a lot of other people some time to really grasp onto.
Yeah, and especially because also when you're measuring against Yamaha's two-stroke 250, that was probably the best bike in the class at the time and was for many years. So you had a good base. You're like, this is the best two-stroke there is. And here's a four-stroke that can, you know, can hang with it.
And absolutely, like we had out when doing the Doug Henry bike, that first works bike, we had good race two-stroke 250s out there as well. And we're going, man, this thing's better than that. And that is an incredible bike, you know, our race two-strokes at that time. So, yeah, it was definitely eye-opening for me, and I was on board pretty early on, you know, before that 400 ever actually was released.
Right.
I was telling, you know, internal people that, you know, you guys don't even realize what you've done here. This is going to be pretty amazing. And I'll tell you a quick little addition to that is I went up to Canada in 2000 to race their outdoor motocross series. And it was amazing to me because it already was kind of grabbing on down, you know, this, a lot of the guys that wanted that experience were buying them down here, but you'd see quite a few of them in Southern California. In 2000, so that's the third model year of that bike, and I went to Canada, and they were having big entries there, 100, you know, between 80 and 120 at every round in that MX1 class. I was the only guy on a four-stroke. I think in that nine-round series, I ran into two other guys.
Yeah,
and they didn't even qualify for the day program.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
they were out, you know, by the end of Saturday's qualifying. And but I won 13 of the 18 motos, and we just handed it to those guys. I had it wrapped up with like three motos left over, and you know, won the truck, got the title, did everything, and it was amazing to me that those guys were still looking at me like, oh, it's just a trail bike.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait, is that what you think when you ride by and I'm standing on the podium?
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And well, you had Alan Olson in your corner, too. So, you know,
well, yeah, I was cheating. Yeah, I had the unfair advantage with that guy standing there.
Exactly.
I mean, how could you not give 100% with that guy smiling on the side of the track?
Yeah, I believe the next year after, you know, because I'm Canadian, so I believe the next year after you left, everyone was on four strokes.
Yeah, I think a lot of them were. I think the Blackfoot guys were the last holdouts. I think they, you know, Wah rode that CR250 for another year, maybe two.
Maybe, yeah.
And then finally, about 04, I think he finally went,
forget it.
I'm working way too hard for this.
Also,
I better get myself a four-stroke.
You talk about how you were telling the Yamaha guys that they were onto something. Someone probably should have told the AMA, too, with the rules. You know, like, they had no idea either. I think when that thing came out, they were like, oh, crap, you know? we made those CCs a little high, guys.
Yeah.
But once the cat is out of the barn, that's the cow or somebody is out of the barn, that's all you can do. Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to these shows. Unfortunately, now it's time to pay the bills. So just stick around, listen to this commercial, support btosports.com, and then we'll be right back to the soothing sounds of my voice.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped to anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at BTOsports.com.
Did you see the future as far as the aluminum frame and the EFIs? I mean, is that what you were, like, is that sort of?
Well, yeah, I mean, we saw it, obviously, in, I mean, look at Jackie Vimon, you know, yeah. He rode a aluminum frame Yamaha in, you know, late 80s.
Yeah, did you ever ride that bike?
Yeah, that thing was crazy. Yeah, or not the early 80s he was riding that bike. Yeah, it was not the best handling bike in the world. I mean, those were some early projects that was still, you know, learning the boundaries of an aluminum chassis, but it was coming. You know, the technology was there. You know, there was fuel injection in street bikes and, you know, ATVs and things that, you know, there was certainly the challenges with fuel injection, but you knew that eventually that was going to find its way into the motocross bike. So, yeah, you know, that's one of the benefits I have of working in those circles is I do have a crystal ball to the future. I see what's coming down the pike, you know, in the next couple of years. So,
you know, I did one of these with Rich Taylor, longtime Suzuki and Honda test rider. We actually joked about, I was talking to Rich about doing one with both of you guys, and you guys could laugh about each other, the stories or whatever. But anyways, you know, he was telling me that there were times at Honda especially where he was like, hey, guys, that bike is not good. You can't release that bike. You know, the Japanese would make changes while after they would take the bike away. He would bring it back, and he'd be like, no, this isn't good for whatever reason. And he got in a little bit of trouble for it at times. But has there been times where you've been frustrated because for whatever reason, politics, something gets released where you're like, I think this is the wrong direction. Has that happened to you?
You know, it exists, and again, I'd be lying if I said, oh, no, we're perfect over at Yamaha.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I like to think, because, you know, there's been very few backwards years, as I call them, over there at Yamaha, and, you know, we've got a pretty good amount of clout on the U.S. side that the Japanese side is pretty receptive. You know, there's a great story of Ed Scheidler. This is back still steel frame 125. Mm-hmm. I want to say there was still a white frame then, so it was, gosh, probably late 80s.
Yeah, I think they went away in like 94.
They were putting these cross braces up kind of behind the head tube. They were just stamped holes in the earlier models, and then they wanted to weld tubes across there to give more rigidity. And we went round and round, and we were making the KYB guys life just miserable. These forks suck. These forks suck. So Scheidler, this is a famous story. He just gets out his die grinder because he's telling them that chassis. That's what it is. That's what it is. And these guys are like, no. It's not the chassis. Not the chassis. He gets out his die grinder, and these Japanese are standing there with their mouths dropped. What is and he just starts grinding these tubes out of their only prototype bike.
Really?
But Scheidler had that kind of command that they just all stood back.
Yeah.
They were afraid to what might happen if they tried to step in and stop him. And sure enough, we had enough power.
It worked
to I mean that decision had been made, come and gone, and you know, Scheidler stormed upstairs and pounded on people's desks, and, and we got those tubes removed out of there before production. So we're not that successful every time.
Yeah, but
that's just a funny story, you know, this famous grinder of Ed Scheidler's.
Rich was saying 97 CR250 aluminum frame. That was one of his stories where he was like, I don't know what happened from the pre-pro to the production bike. Like, I don't know what they did. You know, he was thinking that they beefed up the aluminum so much because they were really scared of it breaking on a consumer, obviously. And, and he was like, it's not, it was not good. So that was kind of a story that he had about fighting with Dave Arnold and the Japanese guys. But
The problem that happens is, you know, these deadlines come and a decision has to be made. And, you know, there's not always extra time or extra budget by the time it's figured out later through some other test or whatever that, But that's too late now.
Yeah, oops.
They're already building those right now, so yeah, it exists.
One bike that you developed that you wish you had a do-over on? That maybe something got changed and it wasn't as good, or maybe it just wasn't that good stock?
Probably, and again, this was too late, you know, out of our hands, but, you know, when the YZ450 first went from 426 to 450 in 03, yeah, that was just too powerful. You know, the 4-speed wasn't a real good match for that engine. It just was, that was a tough one, but, you know, that there was no doing it by us. You know, when we received that project, those decisions had already been made, the 4-speed and, you know, the engine design. So all we could do was kind of, you know, tune things back a little. And, you know, I sold a lot of flywheel weights and exhaust that year to try and shape that thing to...
I was just going to say that. I was Ferry's mechanic, and, flywheel weights, and mellower, and also it seemed like every year, 04, 05, the intakes got smaller, you know what I mean, just more tractable, just trying to smooth it out.
Well, exactly, that's what I did to mine. I did that early on before they ever did it. I shrunk my intake by, like, 25%.
Right.
I just got some of that horse putty. You probably remember horse putty there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we filled those all in, reshaped them, and got the thing rideable, but it was hard to get the consumer to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, guys.
By the way, go to Japan.
Yeah.
And in Tokyo Hands, in that hardware store, you can go get you some horse putty. And
yeah, no, Bob had it. You know, Bob probably still has it in that drawer in his desk.
exactly.
Also, too, you know, as an R&D guy, you ride all the other bikes. You do for Dr. D anyways. You ride every other bike. So you kind of know, hey, this bike, this model does this better, and you know, this one does that better or worse or whatever. We're on the right track with that. How much does that come into play in designing a new model? Like, do you kind of just, here's the agenda, here's where we're going, damn the competition?
No, I mean, it plays in big, you know, and that's another thing you take away from working with the OEMs. You know, they understand how to make something better, more desirable to the consumer. If this is desirable, then, you know, that's what you migrate towards. So it works for the work I do with KYB, Yamaha, my own company. I know, okay, if everyone likes this bike's engine character, that's what you try and shape things towards, because there's a reason everyone likes it. And, you know, I identify it often before anyone else does. Hey, that one's really good, even though you may not think that is, but try that one again. And so you learn by what's out there and what's available. And, you know, we've done that for years. I think that helped me quite a bit in my early years of DRD. Is I rode every color bike extensively. You know, I had more laps on non-Yamaha bikes than probably most people, because that's what we rode all day long to compare to our Yamahas.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it came time to shape a pipe, I already knew at that track, this track, that track, and that track that this one bike was, you know, very soft on the bottom or really flat over the top or whatever. So I already knew how I would set out to improve that model or, you know, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. What about the 2010 450 Yamaha? Obviously a groundbreaking bike, direct injection. I don't know if you call it that or not. You probably have some sort of name for it. But the direct fuel injection right above the cylinder, the exhaust pipe coming out the back of the bike. How proud are you of that thing, and how much testing was on that bike? Tons, I guess.
Well, that was another one of those, you know, a million flights to Japan, and, you know, we rode that bike very early. We were involved with that project. You know, some milder changes we don't get involved till later, you know, stage 3 or 4, and that thing, yeah, we were involved very first proto testing. And, you know, there's certain things you wish. You know, you wish it was a little bit lighter, or you wish some, you know, other characters, but really that is a very, very good bike. I think a lot of people, it didn't wow them, and so a lot of people weren't really thrilled with it at first, but I think you'll see that certain magazines, and I kind of was talking to a friend of mine the other day that, oh, this one might win this shootout, and that one might win, but in a different magazine, the same one that won is in last place on another shootout, but the Yamaha is always right there.
Right.
It's a very solid bike. You know, it just is good in a lot of aspects, but, you know, a lot of people like to pick one zingy thing, and then that pushes it up to the top of the shootout. But, yeah I mean, very solid bike. So, yeah, well, I mean, I love being associated with the development of that because it is such a solid bike, no real big flaws where, again, that's kind of my philosophy, you know. It doesn't have to be fantastic here and neglect those other things. Right. Let's just make it good everywhere, so then that way it's – the customer has a good experience.
I feel like with that bike, and talking to race team buddies of mine, riders that I know, I feel like that bike, it got released a little late, and I feel like it's going to be a better bike this year and next year because more and more people are going to figure it out. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that is what it had up against it for its first release. You know, James has got on it. He had more time than anyone, but he still didn't have much on it. Everyone else, same thing. I mean, you're catching up and chasing all year long, and
Right. Not
a lot of parts available. Not a lot of other outside people had time to help you along with your individual rider's needs and whatnot. So it's, yeah, that was definitely a tough first year. But, yeah, I think this year everyone's got some time. They know their little tweaks, and they know where they're going to go with it. But, you know, a lot of guys jumped on that bike and did very well right off the bat. So.
Right. And as much as you can tell us, when's a new 250F coming?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, all right, fine. I didn't know how much you'd go there.
Are you talking about Husaberg 250F? Because
yeah,
I don't know.
All right, Doc. Whatever.
Right, you can't put me on the spot. That's why I have this job
right.
for 25 years, is because I avoid those tough questions.
I hope soon. Hey, you talked a little bit about magazines, and I'd love to get into this because I talked to Dave Arnold about this on one of these shows, and Larry Brooks, who was MXA guy forever, Rich Taylor. How frustrating is it to work so hard on a model and have it come out and be maybe not ripped apart, but you know, be criticized in the magazines and sometimes not even correctly? Is that part of a bummer job?
Well, I think,
and
I know exactly what you're asking here, and if it's getting beat up for something you know, you swallow that down
right.
because you're going, well, you know, you can fool some, but you can't fool them all. But
right.
when it's unjustly beat up because whatever, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I can go into a thousand
yeah,
reasons
right,
why
right.
people, you know, do the strange things they do. But those are hard pills to swallow because, yeah, it's some people will write with their nice little pen without even the foggiest idea of what it took to get it there and how
right.
good that bike is. Just because it falls a little short of that in this respect, it's all of a sudden a hunk of junk. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, those are tough to deal with.
Do you take it personally? It sounds like you do a little bit. You do get a little ticked off, I guess?
Yeah, because you do when... And you read it. I mean, you read all the books. It's the inconsistency is there. If you went down the line, and I don't know, you know, I try not to dig too deep into the whys and the hows, but and that's why I mentioned the Yamaha technically is the best 450, because if you read all the books over the last couple of years and you averaged it, yeah, the Yamaha is the clear winner, because this magazine picks this one first and the
right.
next one picks that same bike last.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is so mixed that, you know, A, you think, oh, they're all crazy. They don't know what they're doing. They're not hiring good test guys. Or B, there's other outside agendas that no one wants to admit exist. Or, you know, I mean, you could kind of go on into all kinds
yeah,
of conspiracy
yeah.
theories and until your head exploded. But, yeah, it is what it is.
Right.
And, you know, I think some of them do a good job of saying, hey, you know, this is the one we picked, but it really isn't a bad one in the bunch, you know, because that is the reality. Nobody, short of some, you know, durability things that I can identify with complaining about that, and that's one of the things that Yamaha is so strong about is their durability.
It
so
is, you're right.
I always have a good feeling there. But yeah, if you buy a $8,000 motorcycle and the piston falls out of it after 10 hours, yeah, I think
right.
I'd be a little disappointed too.
Can you give us an example? Don't make it recent because maybe someone will get pissed off. But give us an example of. I mean, good God, you've been doing this for 20 years. Give us an example of a model that was criticized for something that. And you can say names or you don't have to, who they were crazy about. Can you give us So they're so well, far
one
off
thing
base.
Comes to mind, and I'd say it right to his face, Jimmy Lewis of Dirt Rider magazine. I don't know if he worked for Dirt Rider then or Cycle right. World then, but he picked the that 97 CR250 as the best 250 out there.
Oh.
And still to this day, I'm like, Jimmy, I know you've hit your head. You've cooked yourself in Dakar. I mean, what is it that you think
well, even Rich
that
Taylor.
Bike was great about? Everybody that rode that went immediately and got a life insurance program before they rode it again.
Right.
That was the most evil. I mean, look at McGrath. I mean, Lusk. The stories go on and on about mm-hmm. that. And so that's one that that's, comes to okay. mind, and I won't hurt anyone's feelings because I tell Jimmy Lewis that yeah. all the time.
Well, because Dave Arnold and Rich Taylor both admitted to me that bike sucks, and they work for Honda. So Jimmy clearly was off base on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't get it right every time, but right. yeah, that's one that comes to mind when I think of someone that definitely missed the mark on an evaluation.
I don't feel like this, but there is a perception out there because I haven't been around nearly as long as you, but I've been around a long time, read a lot of magazines. There's a perception out there that you Motocross Action is in Yamaha's pocket. Yeah, that is in Yamaha's pocket because of all the shootout wins and all this. And obviously your relationship with Jody is strong, the Glen Helen connection and all that. I remember a time when Honda was winning everything, so I don't buy into that. But do you hear that out there? Do you get something?
I hear it from everything mm-hmm. imaginable. That one I hear, yeah, more than the rest, but I just snicker, whatever, because, yeah, you look at it the last couple of years, it's MXA that's picked the KTM, you know, and I ride them all, and it's certainly as a test rider, not the bike I would pick, but for whatever their flavor and the whatnot, and it is what it is. You can't fight it. You just have to go, okay, well, you know, what is it that why, and, you know, and you work with them and try and improve the product to what their needs are, and you move on because, it is just like you say. It's almost cyclical where all of a sudden, it seems like Suzuki's are doing really good right now when, the bike is not that much different than it was before. But all of a sudden, is everyone tired of calling the Kawasaki the winner or the Yamaha the winner? I think there's a lot of underlying things that happen within those, and then it just the results are what they are, and you move on to the next one.
Right. The 2010 YZ or 2011 YZ450 with the pipe being a spiral, there not being a whole lot of room back there to do anything. What can you do on his exhaust guy to make that thing better? What does DRD do?
Well, you still have all the same opportunities there as with anything else. You know, it's confined into a little bit different shape. But now we still can build tapers in there and put chambers and we've got the sky's the limit. And the fact of the matter is the stock pipe is very good on that bike. So we've had to do extra work, extra laps, which of course I don't mind, but to come up with something that's better than the OEM.
Right, right. Also, too, resonance chambers are big in the exhaust companies right now, and I've seen a few of yours have them as well. Can you talk about the benefit of that, and does it benefit every model, or what's your take on that?
Well, in our experience, it doesn't benefit every model. That's why you'll see them on some and not on others. Not mm-hmm. like, oops, we forgot, or, oh, that's too expensive. It's just, typically a resonating chamber, it's an amount of volume. And so, in theory, it was for sound. A lot of guys used it for sound, mm-hmm. but there is some tuning feature to it. So depending on the location in the pipe and the size of what we call the piston, the transfer chamber from the main tube up to the resonance chamber, mm-hmm. and the volume of the chamber. So there's some tunability in there, and when we see some benefit, when we go through all of our exercises, we will utilize that where necessary. But certain bikes, depending on length, volume, placement, that aren't seeing a benefit, we're not going to just stick it on there because it's an image of the company.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I'm too much of a, kind of a gearhead to fall into the gimmicky world. So, if it's there and it's doing some good, then I'm all behind it, and you'll see it on those particular models.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, you're right. It's some companies have it on every one, and some don't, and some don't have any. So it's interesting to hear that from you. Do you have a favorite production bike? Is it the YZ400? Do you have a favorite one?
You know, there's a couple bikes in there that the first year 426 YZ was one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah?
Because it still had the 400 character, but was just stronger. Because, you know, we all knew what the 450 did.
Yeah.
And we all kind of wish we were on 426s with a 5-speed and really good broad power.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, it's probably YZ426 really stands out. And then another good bike that I think anyone that's got any sense at all in the testing world was 08 CR450.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that was another great bike, and I think anyone would lie to you if they said otherwise. But
wow, look at you talking about a Honda like that.
Well, I mean, it's the facts, and, you know, I think our YZ450 is a very solid bike, you know, the current 10 and 11, and, you know, there's other good bikes out there. You know, you can read any book, and they have a lot of truths in there, you know, not 100%, but,
yeah.
You know, so you've got Cowies with a good motor and, you know, KTM's motor and kind of easy riding package, and, you know, they've all got their strong suits, and so, but, yeah, I think as an overall package, when I think back in the years, that 426 and, like, that 08 Honda 450 and some of the 250Fs, I think the early 250F Yamaha, obviously it was just kind of groundbreaking, so that thing was fabulous, and, yeah, there's been some fun stuff out there. You know, obviously YZ 252 strokes still on the top of my list. I love going out and riding that two-stroke race when it comes around once a year. It's a blast.
Yeah, those are hard bikes to beat. I mean, still, if you talk to Chad or Chad Reed or Timmy Ferry, or they'll tell you about their YZ 250s from, you know, 05, 04, 05, the steel frame ones.
I mean, they were. I mean, that was the state of the art. And still is, to a lot of respect. I got buddies of mine looking for them in the paper and whatnot, and they say they're hard to come by.
Yeah.
A good YZ250 that's not just been flipped in the desert 100 times, you just can't find them.
I had an interesting conversation with a top supercross racer who goes by the initials of CR, and he was telling me that in a way he almost prefers a carburetor to an EFI, but not in the sense of the unreliableness of a carburetor on a supercross track, but the way a carburetor delivers power and the way it gives you more of a seat of the pants feel versus an EFI. What's your thoughts on that? As a guy that's, again, done 8 million laps on both of them, what's your thoughts?
Well, I have to be careful while answering this, but
You want to skip the question? We can skip it.
No. I mean, I can't deny what he's saying because, you know, EFI is its benefits. If you had a pros and cons column, you know, so on the good side is, yeah, you're not going to have any hiccup, any delay, any of the things that we all fought through with carburetors. But in order to run that system, it takes energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, frictional power loss is some, you know, a term that's used in valve train or, you know, anywhere, transmission, you name it.
Right.
You know, to drive those coils has a certain amount of juice that it's taking, and then in that, you know, carburetors got very good in the way they delivered the fuel and how much at what time, and you know, fuel injection is very clean and very consistent, but there are certain characters in there that have not been matched perfectly or to a level in a certain RPM, and that's what I think that mystery person with the initial CR. That's what he's referring to, because anyone that's put enough laps on both styles, and especially back-to-back, it hasn't been repeated perfectly yet, even though you do have all those other benefits.
Yeah, it's just interesting, and I don't think any of those guys would take it over what they have now, but...
No, because the benefits outweigh everything else. But, yeah, I think if you could have both, that would be the box I would check.
Exactly. What? Give me an idea of some of the more talented guys that you've raced with, against, or on your teams. It's guys that were just incredible on a motorcycle.
Well, you know, my default guy, anytime I'm asked this question, is the Dogger.
Right, right.
I mean, I don't think anyone could argue with any success that that guy didn't have mad skills to ride a motorcycle.
Right.
You know, you can look at guys that just did it really well, you know, the Jean-Michel Bales, you know, I would kind of put in that Lachine category. And then, you know, there's other talents, you know, the McGraths who had just enough of that but had kind of this cat-like skill to just fall into a pile of crap and come out smelling like roses. You know, that was kind of the Jeremy Strong point. And, you know, then you've got the Carmichael, which, you know, how can you leave him off the list? But, you know, I think he got everything just through heart and grit, and he was never truly the fastest guy. If you put some of that heart and grit into Lachine, he'd have probably lapped Carmichael.
Yeah, that's what the stories say.
But, I mean, that's just, you know, I've seen all those guys. I've raced with a lot of them and watched a lot more, and, you know, it's just, you know, a lot of people like to talk about the, you know, a lot older eras, the Hannas and the, you know, whoever, and the Howertons and things like that. And, you know, when you factor in the junk they had to ride, respectively, those guys had some very, very high levels of determination and skill and whatnot. But, yeah, I don't know. There's certainly a lot of the more modern guys that have, you know, because I look at it like Jeremy was always so great, because I say he's the closest guy to having 100% of the ingredients it took to be a champion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these other guys, they have, you know, 89% or 92%, and some of, you know, that 7% that's missing from one guy is really detrimental to his. And, you know, the 9% missing from the other guy, it's not that big a deal because it only bites them every once in a while. And, you know, so, I mean, you can go on and really sort of break it down from guy to guy. And, you know, we could have this discussion for the rest of our lives practically, but,
well,
you know, I am happy with the last 5 to 7 years, because there was a pretty big void there of only a couple of good guys. You know, this complete almost saturation of European riders, because our local pool was weak. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Where now I really like to see some of the skill that's coming through. Not to say that we're completely without foreign riders, and believe me, I welcome them all. I've raced against them all over the pond and you know, across the pond, everywhere. You know, I mean, I love racing those guys, and don't get me wrong, I'm not like picking on Euros, but just when you look at it, and I loved it. I mean, Albertine and, you know, these guys, I love just hanging out with them today. I see Greg out riding, and, you know, funny, he's got a TRD pipe on the Suzuki he borrowed from somebody, so I give him a hard time. I go, did I have to pay you for that? But, you know, it's just all these guys I have a great amount of respect for, but my point is I really love seeing, you know, the Canards and some of these guys coming up, the Barshas, and, you know, just a little bit of this tenacity and some skill coming back to the front from the U.S. side, you know, obviously the Dungey and Stewart and them, but, you know, that's very good to see, because, you know, I think our society kind of creates little baby prima donnas, and I won't go into the whole Bob Hanna that I was tougher than the rest of the world and I'll never be as good. I don't quite take that tact, but, you know, there's a lot of truth to what those guys say, that you see sort of what the U.S. society does to our children, and, you know, I mean, I got 20-something employees out there that I want to drag aside and say, hey, bring your parents down here. I need to talk to them.
I would love to get...
But you know exactly what I'm saying.
Oh, I do. And I knew exactly if I asked you that question, I would get a very good analytical response. So that's why I brought that up. You know what I mean? Because I know that...
Yeah.
That's up your alley. What about these seminars you're doing? I read something about them, or I saw a press release about them. Talk about a little bit about those.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny, and I'm always long-winded, so just cut me off any time. It kind of started back when we were first going to Loretta's, maybe my second year going to Loretta's, you know, just having a good time racing some of that, riding with some of the guys we supported. And I remember being parked next to this kid and just kind of helping the kid. He was struggling. His dad was kind of yelling at him. And I'm going, oh, dude, you know, just kind of look at it this way. And I was kind of pushing his dad back, like, hey, you know, you got to communicate with the kid. You got to, you know. He's out here because he wants to have a good time, but if you're going to make this his experience, he's not going to want to come back.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to, as soon as he gets a car and can drive, he's the last guy he's going to invite to the races is you. And not only is that, you're going to, you know, hurt this relationship. You're not helping him at the races. You know, he's all bound up because he's worried about what you think. And,
right.
you know, so we kind of went into this whole thing. And it's, you know, all through my career, that was my gremlin that I fought against, was placing myself where I thought I should be. You know, I came from definitely meager beginnings, you know, buying used bikes and, you know, driving beat-up trucks that barely made it to the races, working 19 jobs to, you know, buy a rear tire. I mean, you know, I was truly, you know, I put Guy Cooper in that category. We were kind of the working-class guys that came through and actually did something. But so I read a lot, tried to, you know, a lot of that internal confidence and how you deal with these tough situations. You know, I read all about Pro Golfer. I mean, you name it. I read all of those books. So it was very easy and natural for me to talk to this kid and that. And the funny thing was, the next day, I had like five guys at the back at my motorhome knocking on my door. Hey, can you kind of tell all of what you said yesterday? And so I'm going, oh, okay. And I talked and talked.
Right.
And so I kind of spawned this idea. So then at Loretta's, we just, you know, got the guys all. They were very gracious at Yamaha. Gave us their tent and a bunch of chairs. You know,
you
all
this
the
thing, this thing
MX
started,
sports guy.
This just started. This just started spur of the moment. This was just
It was just purely by me talking
wow.
to some guys about racing and how, you know, how you should look at this, and this is, you know, the kinds of challenges you're going to face, and this is how you best deal with them, and just, you know, just kind of through talking, and then partway through the, you know, maybe a month or so after Loretta's, we were doing our big review, and I said, hey, you know, something that was very interesting, and I went through all that with Terry, and Terry's going, oh, you know, you ought to do that. That'd be a great thing.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of gone from there, and now we get a lot of requests. Oh, where are you going to do those NSS, you know, Next Step seminars? And it's just kind of grown and grown, and I've kind of fought it and fought it. I said, you know, at Loretta's, I've got the time because I'm kind of bound to this location.
Yeah.
And I only race one moto, maybe two a day. So now we're putting together some classes and things, trying to organize it, starting off here in Southern California, obviously, because it's easy for me and my time to get to. But,
right.
yeah, we're putting some things together. I think it's going to be up on the website. We're doing, you know, a couple of traditional motocross schools, but that's the kind of thing that I put into it is I'm not just going to tell you, oh, yeah, go wide open over that jump
and,
you know, go fast, take big chances. I really find that when I, especially when I get the parents engaged and I start talking about this is kind of what your kid's experiencing out there and, you know, your influence is having a big impact on it and how, and certainly we talk about technique, oh, you know, starting technique because, you know, my experience with starting and all these things that are vital to racing, but what I really find that people talk about after those seminars that we've done at Loretta's is how much they learn just in general, you know, almost like life experiences and how to deal with pressure and how do you come out of this with the best possible outcome. And so those are things that I think are really cool and fun for me because, you know, I got volumes and volumes of information about that stuff. So, you know, it's so cliche that, oh, you're going to give back. And, yeah, all these things for free that we did at Loretta's, we're going to charge some money for this other stuff because it's really going to take some planning and whatnot. You got to get the people to commit to come do it and all that. So, yeah, we're I'm excited about it because as we've been on the phone here for a very long time, I love to share all these experiences and I love the look of people. You know, I got three young kids that are at the very highest level in these sports they play, and I've never once said, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, and how come you dropped that ball, or why didn't you score it? Never once. I've always, through all my racing experience and everything I've learned over the years, I've just had that kind of personality to just talk them through, and there's times I never even mention it. Hey, let's just go get a sandwich and, you know, whatever, and you got to get that communication to whoever it is. You know, I talk about mechanic to rider communication as well as parent to child because that's, you know, mostly at Loretta's is what's going on. But just how to get, you know, how to kind of push those gremlins away and have that positive attitude with dealing with racing. So
interesting. You're not just getting the old, hey, keep your elbows up. You're not just getting,
exactly.
You know, you're,
put
getting,
that leg out.
Right. Oh, I think that's really cool. And on my, if I get on my soapbox here real quick, I can't believe the number of big name top riders in our sports who have fathers that just can't let go, man. They can't let go, and they're hurting the kids. You know, it's amazing.
I hear exactly what you're saying, and I don't reference names, but I say that because, and I try not to bring it into racing because it's obvious the few that you know, you're pointing out and what I would potentially be pointing out. So I use kind of, you know, soccer and baseball references.
Yeah.
I say, I see these parents and their kids are the ones that don't want to come to practice. They're the ones that potentially, you know, when their dad's sick that day and the cousin brings them, they have a good time because I'm out there. And, you know, I volunteer to coach a lot for a lot of my kids' sports and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we have a great time, and these kids are, like, happy at the end of the day. They want to get out. I see kids that, you know, don't ever even hit the ball, and they're just talking, oh, man, did you see that? They're talking with their friend because they've had an experience of, oh, this guy helped me do it. And then even when I missed it, he told me, that's a great job. You know, you did better than the last one. At least you fell tipped, whatever it is. But you've got to just always put that positive image into their lives because – you know how many people become a Carmichael or a McGrath or whatever. It's like 0.001%. But what we all can take out of this sport is all the lessons that are learned.
Right.
From the discipline, the hard work, the determination, the drive, all that. That's what, you know, allows me to sit in this chair and talk to you about my successful business. Is I've learned that it's not all about that result that day.
Yeah.
You've got to represent yourself well. You've always got to be honest and keep your head up and do those things that will open a lot of doors regardless of what direction you go.
Interesting. Yeah, and I mean, my whole life has been about motocross, as yours has, and it's gotten us into these positions, and it's kind of all we know. But you know what I mean? It applies to a lot of things in life. So that's interesting, Doug. I think that's good luck with that.
Yeah, well, thanks. And that's why we're going to do some classroom in the dirt, you know, because that's where I love to be. But we're going to do some real structured class and talk about and hand out some nice literature that's going to help these people in general. You know, I'm not like I'm one of those motivational speakers. Let's go sell some timeshare.
Living in a van down by the river.
Yeah, exactly. But it's going to be something that I think nobody else has offered, and those opportunities are, you know, they're there, and I you know, I love doing it. So it's, we'll see how it goes. You know, I'm kind of excited about it. I don't have the time, but we're going to, Terry says he's going to make the time for me. So I said, okay.
He's going
to
figure it out.
As long as you get me to a racetrack every once in a while, then I'll sign off on it.
Step one, kids, get an 81 RM125.
That's right.
Hey, what, I don't know if you've ever seen these DVDs called The World's Greatest Supercross Races. It spans like 79 to 88. You're all over them, and you're all over getting hole shots.
Well, you know, it's funny.
Job.
My brother has one of those, and he's told me.
Yeah.
And that's what he said. He goes, yeah, you hole shot at like every main event for like 6 years.
It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. No matter what number you are or whatever, there's Larry Hoffman saying, it's Dubach. He races. It doesn't matter. Real quickly, we're running out of time, but people who are listening to this, what's the number one thing you see people screw up on starts?
Not preparing themselves for that task at hand.
Okay.
A lot of people take it too lightly, and I think that's the – I'll give you my 10-second summary. It takes a lot of small things put together, and I'm going to sound like you know, a housewife baking a cake, but that's a reference I use. If you're going to put 9 ingredients in there, if you fail to put one in, the thing's going to be all messed up. So
You've
got to know what to put into that start, and then you've got to bring all of them each time because you're not going to – you might fake it once in a while and get a good start just by chance.
Yeah.
I say chance because you haven't really planned to get that start because that's a key thing is you got to have a plan and then execute that plan. You know, I got there for a while. It was, you know, RJ made fun of me 1 year at Mammoth, and we were just cracking up because he's starting next to me. He's going, I'm doing everything. You scratch your left eye, I'm scratching my left eye. You drop your glove on the ground, I'm dropping my glove on the ground. He was like, because I did. I had that kind of aura about me that I – but what people – oh, he's just a good starter, and this is it. Every time I went to that start gate, I was focused, and I knew. You know, I assessed what was in – available, dirt, concrete, rough, smooth, slippery, muddy, whatever, and I made the best of it every single time because I cared and I brought all those ingredients each time. So those are the things that people kind of tend to just fluff over that, well, yeah, you know, I got a fast bike or I got a this. Well, yeah, you know, what we discussed earlier, all the power in the world, if it's not good and available to you, is a waste of time.
Right, right. Oh, interesting. And then one last question. How are the new sound rules doing for you? Are you a fan of them? Does it add an extra challenge as an exhaust company to build a pipe for that?
Well, it certainly adds a challenge. I'm a fan of it to a certain degree. I'm definitely on the fence when it comes to, you know, how exciting is racing. You know, versus let's make it good and environmentally friendly to go into, you know, some outdoor facility that's close to some encroaching house or whatever. So, I mean, I definitely see both sides of it. And obviously, we're going to do what's asked of us by the sanctioning bodies. It is interesting. I could really go on about all the differences of the 2 meter max test versus a, you know, like a AMA style, you know, currently 94, but I could change at any moment. But yeah, it's good. You know, I like riding a quieter pipe just because I spend so much time on a bike. So I've never been a fan of, you know, back in the day when people just had these giant end caps and you felt like you crashed because like you come out, your ears are ringing. But
yeah, like when the 426 first came out, like, oh my God, like.
I don't know if you noticed, I always had a smaller exit tip than most anyone back 8 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. No,
because I knew the theories behind and, you know, what was favorable and what was unnecessary. So
right.
Yeah, but it is what it is, and yeah, we're just gives us an extra challenge, and you know, we're up to facing them all. So
right on. Hey, where can people check out? Is it DRD?
Just go to DubockRacing.com.
There we go.
Is the website, and you can go and get some information. I think this little something is up right now, but we're going to have a full page for the seminars and the riding schools and whatnot. And you know, I think we're not going to do a lot. Maybe one a month. Right now, we'll see what happens because, again, you know, Supercross is coming. We're all busy trying to support our teams and whatnot. Yeah. But, and then you go buy some product as make Terry Beal happy. Go buy 20% off holiday promotion tie and carbon and, whatever he thinks I should say. But, just DubockRacing.com. Got a lot of information on there, you know, some other, you know, how to rebuild this or do that. And so there's a lot of information on there. But, yeah, Steve, it was great talking to you. I love talking moto and talking this industry. So, I appreciate all this opportunity you've given me.
Thank you. And like I've gotten great reports on guys like yourself and Rich Taylor and Dave Arnold. And people love to hear the stuff behind the scenes. And I knew that this would make a great show. And thank you for taking the time out of your sure to be busy day to talk to us at BTOsports.com, Trans World Motocross Podcast Show. And I will see you probably at the Supercrosses, huh, Doug?
Yeah, we'll be there running around as we all do at that first race, trying to get it all under control.
Yeah, perfect. All right, man. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
All right, goodbye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show brought to you by Trans World Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Lachine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course, everybody did.
Go Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I will love this.